Thank you for coming back. You've had a chairman who's been derelict in his duty, so we're running over time. We're about 25 minutes by now. So we're going to have to keep moving forward, and we'll move on to Joan Brown to take us through Agenda Reference 3 on asset and liability definitions, recognition and derecognition.
Okay, so we move to Agenda Paper 3, covering the asset and liability definitions, recognition and derecognition. And given the limited time, we've decided to focus on just three or four topics that are discussed in the discussion paper on in these areas. The first is the suggested changes to the definitions, and then the second is some possible additional guidance on obligations that are conditional on the entity's future actions. And then thirdly, as a separate topic, we can discuss suggestions for changing the criteria in the conceptual framework for recognising assets and liabilities. And then, if we've got time, move on for some thoughts on de-recognising assets and liabilities. So if we move first to the asset and liability definitions, you might find it helpful to go to page 4 of Agenda Paper 3, where we've set out the suggested new definitions next to the existing conceptual framework definitions. And you see that the most substantive change would be the removal from both the asset and liability definitions of the notion that the future economic benefits must be expected. And the reason for doing that would be that people have different views on what this term expected actually means. And some people think that it means that the probability of the future economic benefits must exceed some minimum threshold. Now, if this were the case, the definitions would exclude some items, such as purchased or written options and guarantees, that the IASB thinks are clearly assets and liabilities. So the discussion paper suggests replacing the notion that the future economic benefits must be expected with the notion that an asset must be capable of resulting in future economic benefits. And this would mean that the probability of future benefits wouldn't affect the conclusion about whether something is an asset or a liability. However, as we'll come back to later, the IASB might decide that the probability of the future outflows would affect its decisions as to whether that asset or liability should be recognised. But that's a separate matter which we will come back to later. In the meantime, we have two questions for you. The first one is a specific question on page 3 as to whether you agree with the replacement of expected with capable. And then more generally, on page 4, whether you agree with the suggested definitions that result from that change and some other more minor changes.
Good, thanks. Anybody got any comments on the definitions? Mike.
To your first question, Joan, in terms of expectation and capable, yes, fine. And the general question of definitions of the assets and the liabilities. I think on the asset side, we're going to talk about the liabilities later. It really, the key thing here that's not brought out in the short note is that we're dealing with not whole asset, but component rights. And I think that's quite an important part, and that needs some consideration. You can see the arguments, very well made, but it does put a lot of stress on what's the unit of account, sort of how far down and you go dividing this thing where we haven't been able to get anywhere. And I don't think it can be really divorced from the derecognition question. Because, if we lose one component right, well, some off it, comes off the balance sheet. And that, of course, brings up, the repo transaction and the leasing where, we're leasing, it's been a right of use all along. And then at the last minute, we've had to start looking at features of the underlying asset. So I think there are some problems that everybody's struggled with for several years in this area. I'm not sure that the fundamentals of the definition in coming up with that component rights approach, you've actually necessarily tackled and definitively answered the problems that have been nagging at everybody and everything for some years.
Is this more a derecognition?
I think it's very connected, because I'm not sure that you can necessarily divorce the derecognition from the model, because if you've decided it from the definition, because if you've decided that the asset is the component right,
yep,
it kind of follows that you will end up with a derecognition model that says if you lose legal ownership of that individual right, it goes off your balance sheet. So I'm not sure you can take the two separately.
Richard.
Yeah, we're just starting to think about the implications of this, but in thinking about the implications, we seem to be heading, we appear to be heading for a pretty, let's say on the asset side, a pretty wide definition of assets, so that actually quite a lot of things would be, were assets. I mean, then there's all the question about whether you recognise them and, yeah, and at what value you choose to place on them. But we're starting with a much wider position, and we just, I don't know. Well, I think we've got to sort of have to admit we've got to look at the sort of the overall effect as to whether that's going to produce the right answer. But we do note we were wondering whether whether self-generated goodwill meets these sort of definitions, whether labour forces, the workforce, it meets the definition of an asset, and then you have to go through the other decision boxes as to whether it actually ends up appearing on your balance sheet. Agreed, but we are just, we seem to be opening it up very wide on the definition by making that change.
What would it be opening it up to include that isn't already within the definition of an asset? Say, have you got any?
Well, we were thinking about things like the workforce,
what in the suggested definition change?
Well,
from where we are today on whether.
Well, is it the move from the asset has already got built in the expectation, the probability measure in there.
So the fact that you no longer need to have an expectation of, but say you had a workforce at the moment that you would have an expectation of generating.
Yes.
Is it really making a difference there? Because I can see that it makes a difference. If say you took this interpretation that expected must mean say more than 50% likely, you would rule out maybe some options and guarantees and things like that. But I don't know how it would affect something like a workforce, really, or is it just the confidence with which you could say you will get, there'll be future economic benefits?
Yep, I suppose it's something around there. I mean, the whole changing these things has a slightly unsettling effect, which you've got to work through. But so those were our, I have to admit, very sort of preliminary concerns on that.
Martin.
Thanks. So on the asset side, I think the using the word present in there, that made me wonder, and quite a lot of thinking recently around the leases project, do I have a present economic resource when actually my right of use asset is the right to use it over the term of the lease, which is in the future. So is that really present? I can see that it is. And it then begins to question to me whether something which is as fundamental as the leases project at the moment would then work under this conceptual framework. So I wonder,
isn't the lease present as well as future?
So I think the liability is present because you've signed the lease contract and you have the obligation to make the lease payments. But whether, I think that then just makes the question of, well, what is the asset side of your, which is the other side of your lease liability? It's kind of a prepayment that you haven't paid yet, but we need to do something with debit. But is that really a present economic resource at the moment? It will be an economic resource when I have the right to use that ship or building over a period of time, but I'm not sure it's actually a present resource at the balance sheet date.
I think we'd say it would be, but.
And then the other thing is on the liability side, just sort of really testing the definition against kind of obvious things that have that are under current IFRSs. So the one which often comes up is, well, how do I have the obligation? I clearly have the obligation to make next month's payroll payments, but what is it under this definition which prevents me from recognising January's payroll in December? So what is the past event? Is the past event the employee having done that January service, or is the past event having signed the employment contract in the first place? So I will have to pay it, and I know whatever my severance terms are, it's probably more than a month.
Unless
they die.
But no, it's a good question.
They have to deliver the service in order to be able to receive the payment.
Yeah.
They have to work for you for that month.
I think, yes, that's suggesting that the past event would have been the receipt of services from the employee. We'll probably come on to that in the next topic that we talk about, where we're looking at more obligations.
Tom?
Yeah, we had some debate in our project group on the new definitions, and we had the same example, the workforce. Mm-hmm. and I raised the question, but why are we talking now about the workforce and didn't we in the past? And I didn't get a good answer to it. I have the impression that it is the uncertainty. What does that exactly mean? And that people are trying to find out what will be the impact of new definitions. When I look to the suggested definitions, I think they reflect better than the current ones.
Yes.
Because the distinction between what is an asset and when do I recognize the asset is much more clear now. Because in the current definition we are talking about, and then I have to look, it's expected the inflow of economic benefits and to recognize that it could be probable. That is mixed up by a lot of people, so I think it is an improvement. I thought a longer time, and I'm not sure that the workforce is controlled. I do think that lease assets and the right of use, that is an economic resource. An economic resource is a right or another source of a value that is capable of producing economic benefits. And I think when I look to lease contracts and when I have a right to use, when it does not have any economic benefits, I wouldn't have entered into that contract. Where we are struggling with is the executory contracts, because that is also important in recognition as to liability, and there we are still struggling to be honest.
Just one other definitional point, which may be to the question you were posing earlier, Jen, about why is the workforce now in view, and I would assume it's because of the economic resource definition. Which say the right or other source of value, and I think that's the thing that's going to bring things in, and it does strike us as a slightly odd phrase when the whole thing is thought of in terms of rights, that's how it's all been developed, and then we've kind of added on other sources of value, and it feels like I'd like a clearer idea, more circumscribed idea of what a source of value is. In particular, it feels like the benefit stream, whereas you're pointing out earlier, it's not about the benefit stream, it's about the right to the benefit stream. So kind of how does it work? Because, you know, as with other people, I feel a bit uncomfortable about the workforce as the assembled workforce as an asset, so forth.
But you still have to control that workforce, and do you control the workforce?
You do, and you would still have to control that other value. So
I think you then need to understand, talk about, well, what is that other source? What is it? Is it the individual employees, or is the unit of account all of them together, and do you control, what is it that they do all together, and can you control it? And I'm not sure I see what the answer to that is at this stage.
And the unit of control will be decided on a standard by standard level, if I understood the discussion paper well.
I think so.
Okay, John.
Okay, shall we move on? If we move on to the second discussion topic, which is summarised on pages 5 and 6 of Agenda Paper 3. And this is a question to add more guidance that on obligations that have arisen as a result of past events, but which are also conditional on the entity's future actions. And so examples might include obligations to pay employee benefits for past services, but that are conditional on future performance conditions being met by the entity itself. Or another example might be an obligation to pay a levy that's based on past a percentage of past sales, but will only be payable if the entity is still operating in a specific market on some future date. And the question in these situations is whether the past event is sufficient to give rise to a present obligation despite these existing conditions relating to the entity's future actions. And at the moment, there's no guidance on this in the existing conceptual framework, and different IFRSs have taken different approaches. And so if we could add guidance to the conceptual framework to establish principles, we could then use these principles as the basis for developing future IFRSs. And the discussion paper sets out three different views on what these principles might be. And you find them in paragraph 14 on page 6 of Agenda Paper 3. And the first view is that the past event is not sufficient on its own. The present obligation must also be unconditional, and it must be strictly unconditional. So if the entity could do something to avoid the transfer, even if it could only do it in theory, then it doesn't have a present obligation. And view two, I'd say, is a sort of modification of view one. Again, it says that the past event isn't sufficient. The present obligation must be conditional, unconditional. But in assessing whether whether it's conditional or not, you'd look at whether it's practically unconditional. So even if the entity has a theoretical ability to avoid a future transfer, it would nevertheless have a present obligation if it doesn't actually have the practical ability to take the steps necessary to avoid it. And the discussion paper gives a few ideas of what might not be something it could practically avoid, and that would be things, actions that it could only take by significantly curtailing operations or leaving specific markets. And then the third view is a different view. It's that the past event is sufficient. The receipt of the benefits of conducting an activity in exchange for which another party will be able to demand a transfer of resources if further conditions are met is enough to create a present obligation, because the entity no longer has complete discretion to avoid the future transfer. And so if I'm taking further actions, it will end up transferring a resource or exchanging resources on less favourable terms than it would have done in the absence of that past event. That past event is sufficient to create a present obligation. In terms of preliminary views, the ISB has tentatively rejected view one. So if it doesn't think that it entity should omit from the financial statements liabilities that have arisen from past events, and the entity has no practical ability to avoid. But the ISB hasn't reached a preliminary view in favour of either of views two or three, and would very much like to hear thoughts on the two different views.
Anyone like to lead off?
View one, two, or three?
Um,
we discussed this within our group, and we were wondering how to assess if it is practically unconditional. And then we looked to different scenarios, and then in scenario three there are only yeses or almost yes, and then in field two it's yes in most circumstances, which is not rather helpful to understand the concepts between field two and field three. We do not think that field three would result in useful information, and in, because then the management intent is so, the amount of management judgment is so important that it will be very difficult to enforce all kinds of things. So we tend to have a view that a more limited view is better, but we are not sure if the views presented as they are presented give guidance how to assess that it is practical and conditional.
You say that view three would require management judgment or management intent?
In view three, we have the idea that because you call it the present obligation must have arisen from the present, but may be conditional on the entity's future action. So based on the intended action, you will recognize the liability or not. That is what our understanding of this view, and maybe we do not understand it correctly, but that is what we thought about it.
I'm not sure that was what was intended. I think it was more like the past event creates an obligation, that's it. And you might then say, look at your intent in coming to measure that obligation in, you know, how likely do you think it is that you will satisfy the conditions? And that's the thing. But
for example, I have a example. A lot of football players are transferred from one club to another. And in some of those contracts, there is the amount to be paid depends on the number of appearances in the first team. And for example, we there's a transfer from Chelsea to Manchester, and then if the player will appear more than 40 times, there have to be paid an extra amount of 4, 5, 6 million.
Yeah.
And the question is, how will this work in view three? Should that 6 million be recognized as a liability? Is that a part of the liability or not? Because it depends on the number of appearances.
Yep.
The management could say, yes, we have the intention to use them for 80 and or for 90 games. So, and they could say, when I look to my balance sheet, I'm not sure. It's better to say that we do not intend, that we will decide then. So we do not recognize that liability. And we are not sure if this will result in relevant information, because football club A will recognize the full liability and the other team, but they do not, because it's better for the balance sheet. So
what I think view three is saying is more along the lines of, as the player plays, you're receiving the benefits of the player playing, hopefully.
You can doubt.
So that is sufficient to create the obligation to create an obligation to pay this bonus or whatever you pay to him if you exceed this threshold. So as you make progress towards this threshold, you are creating, that in itself is creating the obligation. And then view two would say, well, do I have the practical...
Sorry.
Because you say when you go towards that number of games,
yeah,
you are creating the obligation. That means that at the beginning you will not recognize that extra 6 million?
Not on the day he starts.
Why not?
This probably gets to your problem with the executory contracts bit as well, that you at that point, yes, you've got this contract, but it's effectively at the beginning an executory contract, and you've got obligation, you've got a right to receive the player's services and an obligation to pay the player, and at the outset they're sort of valued at the same.
But I pay an amount to have the possibility to have this player, because the player has a labor contract with his former team. That contract has to be terminated and amount has to be paid. And the amount depends on the number of appearances. So,
but
I
think the point that comes into play here goes back to the earlier discussion of the elements and the definitions and the use of the past event, where the past event is in all three, approach 1, 2, and 3, but what it's saying is you're measuring it by reference to the services provided at the date you're doing the measurement, so that in terms of your football player example, if the player has not played a game yet, I think the past event being consistent in all three approaches would say zero before he plays the first game, you know, if the payment for the fee that is contingent on the number of games he plays. That's just for the piece that's contingent. So
yes.
It's the past event wording in the asset definition that's the hook there.
But where it's an all or nothing amount where you get to 40 games, then is the argument, well, he could die after game 39.
I'm planning to steal Tom's example because I think it's quite a good one actually. But we've talked about view three, and it's basically saying that yes, the liability would accrue as your player plays, because you've had the past event, which is the playing and the progress towards the threshold. And so that's the liability accruing. View two would say, can I practically avoid, do I have the practicability to avoid him meeting this threshold? Now that's where the judgment comes in. And you might say, well, no, I mean, if he's playing well, I don't have the practical ability not to put him in the team. And for that reason, but you do have this judgment in view two as to whether you have the practical ability to keep him off the pitch. You might do if he gets to the game 39 and you say, well, forget game 40.
In this example, that will depend on how successful is the player in your team. Because otherwise you would decide.
Yep.
And you know, you do not know when you start. But
you would have to make, yes, you would have to make a judgment. You might have to say, well, assuming he is successful, do I have the practical ability? He may be successful and I can't stop him being successful. So, given the possibility that he's successful, and I can't stop him being successful, do I have the practical ability to keep him off the pitch for the games that count? And that, so there is a judgment in there. And then view one would say, well, there isn't a liability, because until he's hit 40 games, I don't have to pay a thing. So your example shows the differences quite nicely.
Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I think This is quite a complicated area. I think we found it just looking at the guidance in here on is it all lined up on these conditional liabilities, the view one, view two on these that you're setting out here, but also constructive obligations which come pretty close to this practical ability to avoid, and the economic compulsion issue as well. So I think we would like those all, make sure those are all lined up. I'm not sure they are entirely at the moment. And I think in terms of view one, view two, obviously view three we have to recognise is a more, I think you've talked about judgments being made, I suppose I would express that as complexity, you know, that there is going to be more
there's going to be, once you say, well, it's passed some sort of definition of a liability or liability to be recognised test, then you're into assessing all of that. And so that's more complex than just ruling it out right at the beginning.
Can I just give a quick thought on what the difference is, how you might line up constructive obligations as well, and go back to Tom's example, where throughout this, your example, we were talking about a contractual obligation. And we were talking about, when does this contractual obligation arise? Does it arise as he plays each match? Does it depend on whether we can stop him playing the future matches, or does it happen when the 40 matches are up? Now, I think where you might start considering constructive obligations is when you don't have a contractual obligation to pay him this, but your past practice has always been that if a player gets to 40 matches, you give them a bonus. Now, I think there is no need to interrelate them, because you go through exactly the same steps of when does the obligation arise. But in this case, we're looking at a constructive obligation rather than a contractual obligation. So you decide, does the fact that I've always paid these bonuses mean that I now have a constructive obligation to pay them? And then you would go through the same three steps to decide when that obligation arose. So there are two sort of different issues there.
But I'm afraid there is some misunderstanding about my example, because when I understand you well, you say, I pay the player a bonus.
Oh, is it not the player?
No, it's not the player. It's his former team, his former club who will get
Yeah, you're unlikely to have a habit of paying former clubs just because you feel like it. But okay, say your example involved paying the player. You may have a past practice of giving a bonus.
Then I can imagine that.
Or you may have a contractual obligation to pay him. What I'm trying to bring out is the different what we mean by constructive obligation.
But I was more interested. Was this change in the example mean in the answers to the question is how does it work in view 3 and view 2?
It doesn't change. It just means that instead of talking about a legal obligation, a contractual obligation, we would be talking about a constructive obligation.
No. The answer you gave me before was based on the premise that the payment will be made to the player.
Yeah.
But
if it goes to the other club, does that make a difference? I don't think it does.
I don't think it does at the conceptual framework level. I think, of course, when we're applying the standards, because we have specific standards on employee compensation, then at the standards level, it might start mattering. But if we were answering it only under the conceptual framework, I think whether you're paying the player or his former team doesn't change.
Mike, sorry, we've got to move on.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that's necessarily right, Mary, because if you're paying a former team, you're looking on it as it's a license rather than you're contracting with the player for the services. And this is one of the things that's kind of confusing us about Q2, which we're sort of quite warm to, but don't feel we quite understand it well enough in the discussion paper to be able to at the moment to vote in favour of it, because it's all based on, it seems to be, as I understand it, a bit sort of transactional. Have you received the benefit from someone, so you owe them to pay them? And that makes a big difference whether you think you're hiring the services of the player in a contract with him, or whether you've got a contract with a transferor club, because clearly the contract with the transferor club is conflict, and it's quite hard to understand. And I think it is trying to, you've got to work out what the transaction is as well, because you take the levy one, I quite like it, in as much as it sort of, let's use the word inadvisedly, it matches the payment into the period in which it's measured based on, and it's based on measurement. But you could actually argue, well, when is it the license for? Because if you lose the license on day one of the new period, because you get out of the market, you don't pay, you're not in that industry in the future. So it's payment for next year, in the sense of what gets taken away from you is you don't pay it, you lose the license. So I have some trouble. But, I'm interested in view 2, like it, but needs more development, I think.
If
more
we can
articulation.
Be brief, Pat.
I just wanted to point out that if you read the definitions, the proposed definitions of assets and liabilities on page 4, they're very symmetrical. And then when we get to this notion about conditionality, it's all around the liability side. And so you should be thinking about, well, if they're symmetrical definitions, how would your conclusions with regard to conditionality affect the asset side? Would you have the same view if you were thinking about an asset as you're thinking about a liability?
I think probably Mike covered my point, which was more around I can see the benefit in matching the levy, for instance, to the period it arose in, but I think it is helpful to have the balance sheet as being a position at a point in time with everything that is actually an obligation at that time.
All right, Jan, I think if we could move on to recognition and derecognition in 10 minutes.
Yep. Right, so let's move to recognition, which is the process of including items that meet the definition of an asset and a liability and satisfy any further specified conditions. And there are some conditions specified in the existing conceptual framework. You'll find them in paragraph 18 on page 7. And the first is that it must be probable that any future economic benefit associated with the item will flow to or from the entity. And the second is that the item has a cost of value that can be measured with reliability. Now, you could argue that these two criteria are designed to ensure that assets and liabilities are recognised only when the resulting information would be useful. The first criterion reflects the need for the information to be relevant, or at least sufficiently relevant to justify the cost. And the second reflects the need for the information to be reliable, or to use the more up-to-date terminology, to faithfully represent the item being measured, recognised. However, the first criterion at the moment is a bit of a blunt rule, and it isn't always applied in individual standards. The discussion paper suggests changes that would both update the terminology and apply a slightly more principle-based approach, which is set out in paragraph 20. So in the ISB's preliminary view, an entity should recognise all its assets and liabilities unless the ISB decides from developing or revising a particular standard that recognising the asset or liability would provide users with information that isn't relevant or isn't sufficiently relevant to justify the cost, or that no measure of the asset or liability would result in a faithful representation of that asset or liability and of changes in it. It would be possible to provide further guidance to help the IASB assess when recognising an asset or liability would provide relevant information. And some of the ideas for what that guidance might suggest are set out in paragraph 21. And so the sort of things that might mean that the information wouldn't be relevant enough to justify recognition would be, for example, if the range of possible outcomes is extremely wide, and the likelihood of each outcome is very difficult to estimate. And the sort of thing that the ISB might have in mind, there would be some types of litigation. The second is that if an asset or liability exists, but there's only a very low probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits, in that situation, users might not be interested or find the information about these inflows, that asset or liability, relevant. Other situations mentioned are if identifying the asset or liability is unusually difficult, and this might get back to your point, Richard, of things like some of these intangible assets, yeah. Or D, if measuring the asset or liability requires exceptionally subjective allocations of cash flows, or then finally, if recognising an asset isn't necessary to meet the objectives of financial reporting. And what we'd like to ask you is whether you agree with these suggested changes to the recognition criteria and guidance.
Adam, you can answer this one.
Thanks. I generally agree. I think the danger with doing it's all included unless it's specifically included, which seems to be the premise of paragraph 20, I think that's fine when it comes to the ISB developing standards, because you're clearly going to be considering things before either including or excluding them specifically. But then when it comes to preparers who then would then need to apply the conceptual framework to everything else that isn't subject to a specific standard, and it kind of implies that we would have to consider every possible right and obligation which isn't subject to a standard, then recognize all of them unless they've specifically been excluded by the ISB, and then maybe you might recognize them all at cost of zero, which would then get you back to not having bothered in the first place. But I was just wondering if that's the sort of thought process that it's intended to generate.
Do you have any examples of things that aren't within the scope of a standard and that you would then have to think about?
Well, I guess emissions trading allowances would be an example at the moment. So we would recognise it, and we'd recognise it at zero, at its cost of zero if it was granted for free. So I guess that would then let us get back to the same position we're in at the moment. We're going through an inventory of every single contractual or legal right or obligation that happens to be out there, which is currently carried at zero, and then working through whether that is the correct valuation or not. When you end up getting back to, it doesn't really matter whether you recognise it or not if you're going to recognise it at zero.
So what would you do at the moment? You've got the recognition criteria, you'd still have to identify it, and you'd just say, well, I don't need to recognise it, if you go back to paragraph 18.
I think by using the current criteria of probability, that automatically increases the kind of threshold that its noticeability. It would raise its awareness of it actually existing.
So by dropping the
probability threshold, you're kind of taking it down to a whole load of sort of 5% probability or less.
Might happen.
Items which might happen, which you're obliged to think about whether they should be recognised or not by doing it in this way.
Mary.
Martin, I think the emissions rights is a very good example of something that's not within the scope of current standards that might kick a preparer into looking at the conceptual framework. But one of the general concerns I have is a lot of concerns, comments that have been made today are about how preparers and others would use the framework. And I'm kind of wondering about whether we're worrying about real problems or not, because today there are relatively few things, I think emission rights is a good example, that are outside the scope of current standards. They may not be addressed directly in the standard, here's what you do for X, here's what you do for Y, but they're not excluded from the scope. So I don't think that you'd get to, as a preparer, using the conceptual framework very, very often. So I think we may in some ways be overly emphasizing that and constraining what we say in the conceptual framework. And that's something I'd like people to think about, maybe not so much today, but again, in responses. How often do you think it really will be used actively? Because there are not that many things excluded from the scope these days, as opposed to 15 years ago, say.
Okay, Tom.
I think, Murray, it's a fair comment. On the other hand, if issuers are under pressure, they are very creative in finding assets, and the asset definition is broadened, so it's very difficult to predict what will be the result. But for sure, there will be issuers who will take advantage of the possibility that is created that we have to face. And I'm not able to tell you if we are talking about